Some of our best stories are getting a little love from state and local media organizations. They're nominated for awards, and we think they deserve another listen.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting.
We have some of the most unique geology, soils and rocks, creating probably some of the highest radon levels naturally in the country, maybe the world.
I'm Kara Holzapfel. This week on the Allegheny Front, we follow the natural gas pipeline and float down the Ohio River to bring you some of our favorite stories from the last year. Plus, President Trump promised to build a big, beautiful wall. But the cost might be greater for biodiversity than the price tag indicates. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. We've heard a lot about lead service lines after the Flint water crisis and Pittsburgh's efforts to replace its old pipes. But that's not the only way lead can get into your drinking water. Faucets, fittings, and solder on the pipes inside your house can also contain lead. But if you want to replace older plumbing, it's not always easy to find the right products at the hardware store. Rebecca Williams explains.
Here's the main thing you need to know when you're buying new plumbing. The wetted surfaces of pipes, faucets, and fittings can't have more than 0.25% lead. That's new since the rules changed in 2014 for plumbing products meant for drinking water. If you head to the hardware store, grab your reading glasses. The labels on new products can be really confusing.
You have to pick up each package, examine it. Is it lead-free? Is it third-party certified?
Elin Betanzo met up with me at a hardware store near her house. She directs the Safe Drinking Water Program with the Northeast Midwest Institute. We're in the plumbing section in front of a bunch of faucets and valves.
So I'm seeing these two packages side by side for these faucet connectors, and one is marked clearly on the front of the package lead-free, but there's no third-party certification on that package. Right next to it, there is a package of the same product that has the third-party certification listed, but no marking that says that it is lead-free.
So, she says, if you buy the one that doesn't have any symbols on it from groups that certify a product as lead-free, you're trusting the company. Betanzo grabs a box with a faucet in it and turns it around.
And in the very fine print, it says this product contains less than a 0.25% weighted average lead content on wetted surfaces.
And that's the case for a lot of these packages. You have to look for the tiny print that says it meets the standard, and different companies use different wording. To make things more complicated, Betanzo says you also have to watch for little stickers that say a product is not intended for drinking water. She picks up a package with a bright yellow sticker on it.
So here is a package for an angle valve. It says that it's for ice maker installation, but it's got a sticker on the front that says not for potable water. And so this was a recommendation from EPA. If a hardware store had old stock that met the old definition of lead-free, that they could continue to sell them if they are marked not for potable water.
That old definition of lead-free was enacted in 1986. Back then, plumbing products were allowed to have up to 8% lead in them. On top of all this, there are 8 different groups that certify lead-free products. It's so confusing, EPA has issued an 11-page document to help consumers interpret the certification symbols on plumbing packaging. The EPA says it wants to clear up some of this confusion. It's proposed that all lead-free products be labeled in some way and marked directly on the product itself, not just the package. The agency just finished up its public comment period. It could take a couple of years to finalize the new rules, so keep reading those labels. Both the EPA and the industry trade group Plumbing Manufacturers International declined our interview requests. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Rebecca Williams.
Here's another potential hazard lurking in our homes, radon. Pennsylvania houses and buildings have some of the highest radon levels in the country, and they're trending upward. You can't see or smell radioactive radon gas, but it's the second biggest cause of lung cancer in the U.S. after smoking. The science on radon and how it gets into homes has pretty much been settled for decades. But in this story from last fall, nominated for a Golden Quill Award from the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania, the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant reports that fracking in the Marcellus Shale has some researchers taking a second look at radon.
Radon starts out as uranium. It's naturally in soil and rocks. As the uranium decays, it becomes radon gas and can seep into people's basements. That's common in Pennsylvania. So it's no surprise that there's also radon in the Marcellus Shale, the rock formation that sits under much of the state.
The Marcellus is considered to be a fairly radioactive rock.
Elizabeth Kassman is a researcher in environmental engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. She's seen the numbers. The Environmental Protection Agency estimates that indoor radon causes or contributes to 21,000 lung cancer deaths each year. So after fracking in the Marcellus took off in Pennsylvania, its radioactivity kind of freaked Kassman out.
The more I was reading about the formation and the potential for radon in the natural gas, you know, the more nervous I got.
Concerned about lung cancer, she bought an electric kettle and stopped cooking on the gas stove. More and more Marcellus gas is coming into our homes, and it's bringing up a topic that many experts thought was settled. People like Dave Allard, who've known about radon in homes for a long time.
I've been around the block.
He's currently director of the Bureau of Radiation Protection at the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. Allard says the state already knows why Pennsylvania has high radon levels. It's known since the mid-1980s.
We have some of the most unique geology, soils and rocks, creating probably some of the highest radon levels naturally in the country, maybe the world.
And he says radon in Pennsylvania is trending upward. They've seen some homes with levels 250 times the amount that's actionable by the EPA.
And quite honestly, some of our residential levels in Pennsylvania are higher than you would allow in an occupational setting or a uranium mine.
So the DEP looked into it. Bob Lewis is the state's chief radon officer. He tested more than 30 wellheads in different regions of the state. At each site, he connected stainless steel cells into the gas well systems.
And then flow the natural gas through the cells for 5 to 10 minutes. And then we do the analysis. And from that, we can then calculate the concentration of the radon in that natural gas at that particular wellhead.
They did similar sampling at natural gas power plants, compressor stations, and gas storage facilities.
We collected those samples in order to make some estimates of the end user.
The end user, that's us, cooking and heating our homes with natural gas. The DEP released his findings in early 2015.
And basically our conclusions, they showed that they were receiving very, very small radiation doses from the radon in natural gas.
So for the DEP, the issue was taken care of. Pennsylvanians are already advised to test for radon in their homes, and Marcellus Shale gas wasn't adding to the problem. And then the state's radon experts got kind of blindsided.
Let me just give you, I've got their press, the Hopkins press release right in front of me.
Using the DEP's own data, researchers at Johns Hopkins University published a study in Environmental Health Perspectives. The title, Increased Levels of Radon in Pennsylvania Homes Correspond to Onset of Fracking. Joan Casey was the lead author. She says her team noticed the upswing in radon happened around the same time as the fracking boom.
And we wanted to see if this new industrial development potentially was contributing to increased levels of radon in homes.
They broke up the state into different regions, places with no fracking, some fracking, and high levels of fracking. When people test their homes for radon, the results are filed with the DEP. Casey's team analyzed 860,000 test results in the different regions.
We saw, at the same time that fracking was going on, increased levels of indoor radon in places that had the most fracking.
They also looked more closely at a home or building's proximity to fracking activity.
And we found that buildings that were located closer to more drilled wells had significantly higher indoor radon concentrations than buildings located farther away.
So, needless to say, the DEP's Dave Allard was pretty ticked by the media attention on this study. He thought Casey's findings could unnecessarily scare people. One problem, Allard says, is that radon is trending up in every region of the state, no matter how close or far it is from fracking activity.
Yeah, there's an uptick, but all of it is upticking through time.
So he says there's got to be a different cause. He's convinced it's related to increased soil moisture and says that's backed up by a study from Finland published last year. Casey says her analysis takes rainfall into account. When she looks at her results and those of the DEP study that found a small increase in indoor radon, she says there's reason for concern.
There's no safe level of radon exposure in terms of lung cancer risk, and any increase in radon levels translates into an increased risk of lung cancer. That's definitely true.
Casey doesn't really know why radon levels are increasing. She says maybe it could be entering homes through well water, ambient air, or the use of natural gas on the stove. Which brings us back to Elizabeth Kassman. Remember her? She's the CMU professor who stopped cooking because she was worried that radon in the gas would increase her risk for lung cancer. Like any researcher, she started gathering data. First, she and her team wanted to test right at the kitchen burner, but that wasn't easy.
It's tricky.
So instead, with the agreement from energy companies, they took gas samples from pipelines, and Kassman says she was relieved by the findings.
We took all the worst cases, and still, it came out to a non-scary risk level. And that's when I calmed down about cooking. I'm cooking again.
Kassman says unless someone used their unvented stove to heat their home and they didn't leave the house for 70 years, they wouldn't really have an elevated risk of lung cancer from Marcellus shale gas.
The increment from cooking from the Marcellus only is probably not going to be killing a lot of people.
Still, Kassman and others want more data. But for now, if you're concerned about radon from your gas stove, she says, just open a window. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Julie Grant.
That story was part of our Follow the Pipeline series, which won second place at the Pennsylvania Associated Press Managing Editors Awards this spring. Next week, we're starting a new series, Hazardous to Your Health. We'll look at pollution in Pittsburgh's communities. First, we'll travel to Clairton, just south of Pittsburgh. It's home to the largest coke facility in the country. The U.S. steel plant is also the largest air polluter in Allegheny County. In fact, just this week, a class action lawsuit was filed against the company on behalf of residents, alleging they've been exposed to toxic and hazardous air pollutants that are linked to heart disease, asthma, and other ailments. That's Hazardous to Your Health, next week on the Allegheny Front. Building hydropower on Pittsburgh's rivers could be good for the economy and the environment in the long run, but it has consequences for wildlife and the people who enjoy it.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him?
Later on the Allegheny Front, the case for and against hydropower on the Three Rivers. Stay tuned. Countries recognize borders, but animals and plants don't. The Trump administration's proposed budget out this week earmarks $1.6 billion to get construction started on a southern border wall between the U.S. and Mexico. It's got big implications for property rights, immigration, and trade. But what about the non-human species that live along the border or want to cross it? Well, our friends at Generation Anthropocene looked into it. That's a podcast based at Stanford University featuring stories and conversations about planetary change. Maddie Bellin is a student at Stanford, and she produced this story.
When most people think of an undocumented immigrant, they tend to picture a person crossing the border, often in search of a better life for themselves and their families. To an ecologist, though, undocumented immigrants can look a little bit different.
So what we're focused on here are vertebrate animals that cannot fly. Mammals, except for bats, and then we're talking about amphibians and reptiles.
This is Jesse Lasky, a biology professor at Penn State University. Jesse researches human impacts on biodiversity. Basically, how the stuff we build affects those mammals, amphibians, and reptiles. Back in 2011, he published a paper about what would happen to over 100 species if a border wall completely separated the U.S. and Mexico. In the wake of the 2016 presidential election, Jesse's once-buried paper has had a new life.
I've always kind of had it in my mind that this could come back, but it's maybe a little surprising that it's come back quite so strong, but I guess it shouldn't be based on the Trump campaign because that was really a central promise that he made.
We will build the wall, yes. We will build the wall. Build the wall. Build the wall.
We
will.
We tend to think of the U.S.-Mexico border as being mostly dry desert. but there's actually a much wider range of climate and habitats. A coast-to-coast border wall would be almost 2,000 miles long, and it would cut through lush coastal grasslands, searing hot deserts, and staggering mountain peaks. Jesse's research suggests that a border wall would be especially damaging in regions that have high levels of biodiversity. A lot of species depend on cross-border migration, and his research shows that a wall would block species from their daily travel to find food. On top of that, it would divide each species population into two smaller ones, limiting their ability to interbreed and spread genetic diversity.
You know, one major source of genetic diversity is dispersal from other populations. And if you stop that, then likely get decreases in genetic diversity within populations. You know, we're concerned that lower genetic diversity might be a problem for the potential adaptability of a species in response to environmental change, like something like climate change.
You might expect the species at the border to be mostly little lizards, but it turns out there's actually a much wider variety.
Some examples of that might be like the American black bear, which is pretty widespread in North America, but starts to sort of peter out as you get down to the U.S.-Mexico border.
Black bears are an important example because there just aren't that many of them this far south. Jaguars are also not very common around the border, as the border represents the northern edge of their range. Right now, there's only one jaguar living in the United States. People call him El Jefe. If a border wall were built, he would be left without access to his preferred hunting grounds, and he would be isolated from all the other jaguars in Mexico. El Jefe would essentially be the last of his kind. But even if species have a healthy population size on both sides of the border, restriction of cross-border movements would have serious consequences for day-to-day survival.
Something like a bighorn sheep, which is widespread in North America, but not so much in Mexico. And we have this desert bighorn sheep that lives in the Southwest. And these populations are fairly small and threatened. And, you know, these things are grazing in a place that doesn't get a ton of rainfall. So, you know, they often have to move large distances to find grazing places and also to find mates.
It's clear that building a wall along the border would be potentially catastrophic for species that live there. On the other hand, there's already a lot of development along the border that has had an environmental impact. For example, large sections of a border wall were built during George W. Bush's time in office. So what makes Trump's proposed wall so different?
So one thing to note is that the kind of project they're talking about now would essentially be an impenetrable wall. So, you know, all those other things usually have some sort of openings and penetrability. But what they're talking about now is a solid concrete wall that's 30 feet tall or something like that. So that really stands out.
Dividing species by throwing a wall between them is already disruptive enough. But there's also climate change to factor in. Climate change poses a very real danger to all species, and that threat is amplified in the context of a border wall. As the planet warms, species may have to migrate northwards to live in the same temperatures they're used to.
And we do see lots of movement of the distributions of organisms in response to climate change. So this is something that's happening. If species weren't able to do that anywhere along the border, a lot of those things that would need to shift across the border to track their conditions might get squeezed there so that they would essentially have nowhere to go.
There are a lot of ways to study both climate change and negative human impacts on biodiversity. We asked Jesse why he even decided to look at this hypothetical future wall in the first place.
You know, this is really a large-scale infrastructure project, you know, among the largest scales you can sort of think of. You know, we don't often do in one fell swoop a project that covers, you know, four states and you know, all these very diverse ecosystems. So that was sort of the motivator there, which is, you know, this big project was being plopped down across the continent without really the typical environmental review process.
Let's pause on that for a moment. There are a lot of laws in place that should protect our environment from huge infrastructure projects like this. There's the Endangered Species Act, the Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the list goes on. But in 2005, Congress passed another law that can override all of these regulations. That law, called the Real ID Act, says that any major project pertaining to national security can ignore environmental regulations. So a 2,000-mile concrete wall, one of the biggest infrastructure projects you could possibly imagine, would not need to undergo any sort of environmental review process because it would be built under the auspices of national security. At the end of the day, though, it's impossible to know what the real effects of a border wall would be until after it actually gets built, if it gets built. there could be a lot of unforeseen consequences. So having at least one scientific study to examine the environmental issues is worthwhile.
That's why we tried to do our work to at least put something there where we might have some sense of what might happen. But it's really dramatically an outlier in that sense of the scope of it and the lack of information.
This proposed U.S.-Mexico border wall is certainly not the only one out there. Border walls are becoming more and more common in a post-9/11 world, especially in Europe and other countries experiencing an influx in migrants. Millions of refugees flee their homes and need to cross borders to get to safety. Obviously, the concerns about any border wall go well beyond the environment. But it is worth pointing out that when humans build walls to keep each other out, we also block the movements and threaten the survival of hundreds of other species besides ourselves. These animals share our lands, but not our borders, and especially not our border walls.
That was Stanford student Maddie Bellin with Jesse Lasky of Penn State University. Since that story was produced, the Center for Biological Diversity and an Arizona congressman have filed a lawsuit in federal court to block the wall on environmental grounds. Their lawsuit claims the administration needs to conduct an environmental review. This story came from the podcast Generation Anthropocene in an episode titled, Oh Right, the Animals. You can find Generation Anthropocene on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Stitcher, or at genanthro.com. This is the Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple. Here's another of our favorite stories that was nominated for an award by the Press Club of Western Pennsylvania. It's about clean energy from the Ohio River. The Ohio and its tributaries could become a hotspot for new hydropower development, not by building artificial lakes, but by using the region's extensive network of navigation dams. But as the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier explained last fall as part of our series Headwaters, not everyone wants to take the plunge into hydro.
Behind a chain-link fence, Paul Jacob watches water spill over a dam on Neville Island on the Ohio River near Pittsburgh.
Our project will be just in the water.
The water forms a white froth at the base of the dam, called the Emsworth Back Channel, before flowing into the brown waters of the Ohio. To Jacob, that froth looks like opportunity.
If you look out and you'll see all the water that's flowing over that dam, that basically is unused energy.
Jacob is with Rye Development, a company that's proposed building a small hydropower plant at Emsworth and 9 other dams in western Pennsylvania and West Virginia. If approved, the projects could come online by 2019. Emsworth is part of the Army Corps of Engineers' extensive system of dams along the Ohio and Mississippi River systems. And from Jacob's perspective, these rivers contain a wealth of untapped power.
It's wasted energy that's created by the fact that you've got a flow, a substantial flow of water, and the difference in elevation of the water. What we do is capture that in a turbine, so it basically spins a giant turbine relatively slowly, and then that spins a generator, and that produces the electricity.
The amount of energy these projects can create isn't enormous. The Emsworth Dam could power only 6,000 to 12,000 homes. That's a tiny fraction compared to the million or so homes a big coal-fired power plant or a hydro plant at Niagara Falls can produce. But even at this scale, these projects can benefit the economy and the environment, Jacob says.
It's a carbon-free resource. So once this is built, it'll just operate. The life of these projects is extremely long compared to most other resources. So makes a good contribution in terms of adding a renewable resource that's also available on a 24/7 basis.
That last part is important. Wind and solar don't always produce electricity when the wind doesn't blow or the sun doesn't shine. So adding reliable sources of power is a big push for people trying to get more renewables onto the grid. Fast-growing wind and solar may garner a lot of attention, but hydropower is still the biggest source of renewable energy in the country, accounting for 7% of all electricity in the U.S.
I think that often it's, you know, talked about as the silent renewable.
David Zayas is with the National Hydropower Association. He says hydropower has been around for so long, some people assume there's no room for it to grow. But the Department of Energy says the industry could grow by 50% over the next 3 decades.
You know, the myth of that hydropower is all tapped out and that Yeah, I think Pennsylvania is a really good example of that not being the case.
With its plentiful rainfall and dammed up rivers, the Keystone State is well suited for hydropower development, says Lindsay Baxter of the Pennsylvania Environmental Council. She says hydro also fits well with what a modernized grid will look like.
The future of power generation is going to be more distributed, smaller resources that are very low or no carbon emitting. And hydro feeds into that and could be very complementary to some of the other resources like wind and solar.
Baxter's group is pushing for more hydropower, but it doesn't want big new dams that can wipe out habitat or displace homes and businesses. Instead, Baxter thinks building projects onto existing dams makes the most sense.
That's really where we see more of the opportunity, where you have a previously disturbed environment. Sometimes those can be retrofitted to produce power with very little or no impacts on the environment.
Actually, some worry new hydropower plants, even on existing dams, could be bad for rivers. On a recent afternoon, Rob Walters took me on a cruise up the Allegheny River, a few miles from where it flows into the Ohio.
A few times a year, and there is one guy fishing.
Over there?
No, over here to the left, see the white.
Walters is with Three Rivers Waterkeeper. The group monitors water quality on Pittsburgh's rivers, which have slowly seen fish populations increase after decades of industrial pollution. We're idling just below the Highland Park Dam, the site of one of Rye Development's proposed hydroelectric projects. He says this is one of the best spots on the river to fish.
Why are the fish there and not just, like, I don't know, in the middle of the river?
The dissolved oxygen. There's more oxygen concentrated at the dam. It's turbulent.
The dam acts like one of those aerators in an aquarium, infusing the water in this section of the river or pool with oxygen, feeding plants, fish, and other wildlife. A hydropower plant would funnel some of the turbulent water into turbines instead of letting it tumble over the dam. State and federal wildlife agencies say this could drop the river's oxygen levels, which already run low during the summer.
Maybe not specifically in one pool, but the cumulative impact we're talking about, basically every lock and dam on the Monongahela River, the Ohio River, there already is one up on the Allegheny River at the moment. This would be another one.
The developer will need to negotiate with the Corps of Engineers over how much river flow and dissolved oxygen it can divert for the project. But Walters says oxygen isn't all that worries him. He points to a spit of rocks just below the dam. A man sits there on a portable chair. Next to him, a cooler, a bait bucket, and a fishing rod. Walters is worried this spot could get taken out by the hydropower plant, though he doesn't know what the final plan will look like.
To the gentleman that's up there, yeah, definitely looks like he's doing a little catfishing. This is his Yosemite. And why should we take that away from him? And he should have a voice in saying that, you know, every Tuesday afternoon he comes down here with his kids or his grandkids or by himself and he fishes and catches catfish and maybe he takes one home and he eats it.
Walter says he's in favor of clean energy, but he doesn't want it to come at the cost of the region's still recovering rivers and those who use them. For the Allegheny Front, I'm Reed Frazier.
Since that story aired, Rye Development announced it has received a license from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission to build its hydropower plant at the Highland Park Dam in Pittsburgh. Thanks for listening to the Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. We're at Allegheny Front. I'm Carol Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments and the Benedum Foundation.